You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And we've got a special episode for you today. We promised it, what was it, 3 weeks ago?
Yeah, something like that. And here's the thing, like, I thought this was going to be a 30-minute conversation, and it went, like, over an hour. I've edited it down somewhat. But it's me and Kim Renfro, the pop culture editor over at Insider, who did a lot of – she's doing a lot of work this year. She's got a lot of exclusive interviews, the cast and crew. She was one of the ones that put the kibosh on the Longclaw opening his eyes argument. She had an interview with Alan Taylor where she put it to him, and he's like, that's nonsense. No, Longclaw's not a sentient sword. And we had a really, really fascinating conversation because Kim was one of the ones that indulged in the leaks pre-season. So we're talking about the aftermath of that. There's some inside ball and like the impact of that as a – she's not a podcaster. She's a culture writer. But, it's kind of a similar lane to be in. Mm-hmm. The other thing I want to talk about is I mentioned in the spoiler podcast like I think 2 weeks ago – that there was one major plot point that's still kind of laying out there in the leaks that I was I would not have read the leaks had I known that there was one more landmine out there to step on. And I brought it up with Kim at the very end of her conversation, and I'm going to mark that with extra – with an out. We'll do the full outro and theme music, and then that part where we discuss the leaks is going to be out there. I debated about whether we should include it or not, but I think, there's enough people out there that want that were indulged in the leaks and want to hear the analysis, and the fact I've already got spoiled on that one plot point. Kim and I both think it will be something that they save. We don't think it's going to be cut. We think it's going to be something they save for next year. So okay. If you want to come in next year pure, do not listen to that last couple minutes of the podcast. That's the only thing we'll be talking about. So otherwise, hope you enjoyed the conversation. Here I am with Kim. Oh, real quick, before we get to Kim, I want to remind everybody about the Pod Pack that Jim put together with a bunch of other all-star Game of Thrones podcasters. You can go to podpack.baldmove.com and get a load of that. Half of it's going to charity. It's divided up amongst the other podcasters. And also, Jim and I decided to devote 100% of our cut of the proceeds to the Hurricane Harvey Relief Fund. Mm-hmm. We also... This is the Kim podcast, the spoiler podcast for just a feedback session comes out later Friday. And we start season two of Game of Thrones next week. Again, that's a spoil. The first part of that podcast will be a spoiler free review and discussion of the episode itself. And then we'll have a bit of general feedback, and then we'll have a spoiler edition where we talk about that episode in terms of the larger Game of Thrones story. Mm-hmm. And also just like, we might just chit chat about current theories or whatever.
Yeah.
American Horror Story Cult season starts this week. In fact, I think Cecily and I are recording that episode tonight. We also coming up, Game of Thrones is going away, but there's still lots of stuff coming down the pike. Stranger Things will have a retrospective coverage of season one leading into the season two premiere. Mr. Robot comes back. The Walking Dead comes back in October. Bald Move Television, Bald Movies, tons of stuff all the time at baldmove.com. Don't forget about us just because Game of Thrones is off the air. All right, now we will get to my interview with Kim Renfro.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest.
And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and ball move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
All right, joining me now is Kim Renfro from The Insider. You are the senior contributor for pop culture. Did I get that right?
Yeah, senior culture reporter.
Senior culture reporter. All right. And we, if you've joined us in between the season or episode one and the conclusion of the season, Kim actually joined us for the our first spoiler episode this season. We talked a little bit about what was going on and what became apparent to me is that you were all spoiled up. You were all spoiled up with the leaks and stuff before the season started. Can I talk to you a little bit about the decision? Like, was there ever a doubt in your mind that you would jump right into that? Or was there a little bit of debate? Or was there, is this like, well, this is my job and I'm going to jump right in? Or was it more like, I'm just kind of curious about how you went ahead and made the decision to indulge in those, and then maybe we can talk about how it maybe affected the coverage and like your opinion on the season.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I made the choice a while ago, probably like 2 years ago now, that I consider reading spoilers to be part of my job at this point, which kind of sucks. But at the same time, I'm one of those people that is really interested and I have basically zero self-control. So it just kind of came with the territory for me. Cause I think as early as season five was when I started reporting on the show, but I wasn't full-time doing it at that point. I was just I was doing like one article a week in my spare time.
Right.
And so season six was when it was really full-time. And that was also when, you know, we were getting full episodes that were leaking. Mm-hmm. And I think part of it comes from the fact that I've always been a Redditor. I was a Redditor before I was a Game of Thrones reporter.
Sure.
And so I was there for the evolution of Free Folk, that subreddit.
Oh, yeah.
I was a lurker. I wasn't involved with it, but I watched as like this entire debacle happened between the moderators and Free Folk emerged, and Free Folk was all about discussing the leaks and spoilers in kind of like an open forum.
Right.
So yeah, with this season, it's not like I made the choice to go seek them out. It was just happening.
Right.
And I was already subscribed to those subreddits and already kind of following the right people on Twitter or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it happened. So I think I became first aware of them in October when that big Reddit dump happened from Away for the Lads. But at the time, I wasn't sure if it was real.
Right.
Because it sounded kind of like it sounded plausible enough, but it also sounded like something that a troll could make up to mess with people.
And I've been doing this long enough where I've seen the spoiler game evolve. Like, I remember when people were leaking shooting scripts from Breaking Bad in season 4 and reading some of those. And then I also remember people like claimed to have shooting scripts for season 5 and they were really plausible with, like, you know, seemingly Vince Gilligan dialogue, and it was all bullshit and made up. So like, I guess that would be the first thing. And when I was reading, because since then I've read the leak, and there's got to be some points where, you know, I guess what was the most kind of like skeptical you were about a particular plot point? Was there anyone that jumped out at you of like, this is crazy, this is nuts?
It was the boat sex. I hated it.
Really?
Hated it.
That was the most implausible thing? The boat sex?
maybe not implausible, but like, it read to me the most like, ugh, like, really? Like, John almost dies and then Danny saves him and then they have sex on a boat for the first time as like some sort of weird like victory emotional thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm also like, it sounded like something someone would make up to mess with people who didn't want John and Danny to get together. And I was kind of one of those people for a long time. So that's the one that I remember freaking out the most about. And then the Viserion ice dragon thing also sounded to me like, when we talked earlier in the season and you asked me, like, is there something that happens that is kind of like a long time coming fan theory thing? Mm-hmm. That's what I was thinking of, is right. that people have talked about ice dragons forever. People have talked about white dragons or right. Bran warging into a dragon.
Yep.
Like, that was a huge thing that, again, I thought someone could just be making up or might be real. And then as the production leaks started trickling in and we got like more and more confirmation that this was really happening, it was probably like February by the time that I realized that that was a legit summary of right. everything that happened.
Right.
You asked about like, so what does that do for me for coverage? And it does makes it really sticky, because I used to love writing about fan theories or doing my own speculation or analysis of scenes that were happening and to like see if that meant that something was coming up. And it kind of made it so that I couldn't do that without being dishonest, because I didn't want to write a whole breakdown of a scene and guess what it might mean for the future if I already knew.
Yeah.
So I had to kind of stay away from doing that too much. But at the same time, I did give myself a break when it was things that I knew that I would have worked out on my own anyways.
It's a bummer. Do you hope in season 8 that they find a way to seal these leaks? Would you rather? Because I know I was debating about this down at Con of Thrones, and some of the podcasters and people that were into, you know, the fan industry were like, this is actually kind of cool because it helps us kind of like, you know, get ahead of the coverage, and we can have like articles kind of like, you know, the main plot points.
Yeah, that's the selfish part of it.
Yeah. So here's the thing. Like, I've got this complicated relationship with spoilers, and maybe this is this is too inside ball for people, but this is just me as a podcaster wanting to talk to another person. Whereas like I don't understand why people are so hypersensitive to spoilers, because like, for example, whether you see Godfather the film first or read the book first, I don't think one can spoil the other, because they're both really good examples of like art, you know? And like, so like I felt, even though I didn't read Game of Thrones before the first season, but then I read like the first three books between seasons 1 and 2, and I read the rest between seasons 2 and 3. And I always felt like that it was just as pleasurable watching something I knew that was going to happen already unfold before me in a really well done way as it was to like read it for the first time.
Yeah.
But this... these leaks kind of vex me, because I've seen this experience with Breaking Bad, Walking Dead, now Game of Thrones, where there's something about just seeing a plot completely devoid of any artifice. Like, it's not got acting behind it. There's no set dressing behind it. It's just a bullet point that says the Night King throws a spear and kills a dragon. That's like, it's like... if you watched a version of The Godfather that was a flip book drawn in crayon, that maybe that could ruin you. Like, that's a spoiler that can, like, and that's where I keep coming back to these spoilers. It's like, it without any of the effect, like, you know, any of the things trying to suspend your disbelief, it feels like it ruins it in a more complete way than almost any other type of spoiling does. What do you think about that? And I guess the real question I'm at, when you read about the plan to capture a white to show Cersei, did that read on the page like as stupid as it seemed when we were watching it for the first time?
It actually didn't. I don't know. I didn't think too hard about it at that point. I was a little bit like, huh, okay. Like, that's really the best that they can come up with. But of all the things in the leak, I wasn't really fussed about that one. But so that's, I think that leads into my kind of feelings on these leaks, is that it's all, there are so many layers to them, right? So for season 7, I think that reading the leaks didn't spoil my enjoyment whatsoever of watching the season, because if anything, the baseline plot points were like the least interesting thing about season 7, or like you could say the worst thing if you want to say like best or worst. Like, for me at this point with season 7, all of my pleasure in it comes from the things like the amazing costumes, like the amazing cinematography, like the score. Mm-hmm. It's not coming from what D&D are like generally doing with these characters anymore, if that makes sense. And so having that ruined for me didn't take away from my enjoyment of getting to watch it play out on screen, because the visuals of it are, I think, what the show is best at this point. However, I don't think that will be the case for season 8, because it's the end. Like, this was a little slice of the middle that I was okay with kind of having spoiled for me. I gotcha. Am going to be really sad if/when, because I feel like there's almost no way that HBO can keep a lid either. On it.
Like, it was bad that it got leaked almost a year. Like, almost as soon as people got the scripts, it felt like someone was feeding that to somebody. But yeah,
right.
I don't see how they keep it with all their foreign affiliates, with all the translation has to be done, with all the court. Like, I just, and with the hundreds of people that have the shooting scripts in their hands, I don't see how they keep it out of the public forever.
I feel like at this point, the only thing that they could maybe do, which would probably be too much effort on their behalf, is put a conscious effort into putting fake leaks out there.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if you saw that Kit Harington, before season 7 aired, he like went on, it was either Jimmy Kimmel or Jimmy Fallon, and he tried to say like, oh yeah, we filmed 15 hours of fake scenes, and so people think that they know what's going to happen, but they really don't. And I was like, that's a lie.
Yeah,
like,
right.
Like, I know what set leaks you're talking about, Kit, and they're all real.
And
so, like, unless they actually tried to do that, or actually tried to, like, circulate some fake scripts along with the real ones and try and confuse people as to what the real
ending was. Canary in the mine kind of cold trap, kind of.
Yeah. But because, like I said, when I first read this overview back in October, I genuinely wasn't convinced one way or another.
Right. But that's the crazy thing, because I take it to understand, because I saw the thread after it'd been fully updated. And as each bullet point of the plot, when someone would get like a telephoto lens of like, Tyrion arrives with Davos on King's Landing to, you know, rescue Gendry or whatever, and there'd be like, you know, telephoto lenses of like, yep, here's Davos and Tyrion on a ship, and oh hey, look, there's Gendry with the Warhammer. I mean, everything is just, it kind of confirms itself, because by and large, these things are shot in real world locations that don't have four walls around them. You know, you're always going to have some, like, you know, scenes inside the boat, you know, like that's like, those are on this closed soundstage, but a lot of
you imagine if the boat sex
had leaked? Yeah, there's like a telephoto lens through the porthole, and But you know, like by and large, that stuff just was being auto confirmed. Like, yeah, every single plot point had you could click on it and see the people taking the photos over in Iceland or wherever, you know, Northern England or whatever. And yeah, it does. It did. I don't know. It did kind of suck the fun out of it. And so I noticed you were careful to say that, like, at this point, frequently when you were talking about, you know, Game of Thrones visual mastery versus its plot intricacy, where do you think, to the extent that you think the wheels have fallen off, and maybe that's another thing, I should have started with this. Where would you say this season? I don't want an outright ranking, but what kind of letter grade would you give it? Like, if the average Game of Thrones season's an A minus, let's say, what would you say season 7 was on the whole?
I'd say a B plus.
Okay, so it's not like a steep drop off.
No, not, and I mean, maybe that's, maybe for me that's a product of me having spent a lot of quiet personal time over the last 2 years coming to terms with the fact that what's happening to the show is happening, which is that they no longer have any books to go off of. And I think it's absolutely clear that that's affecting some of the ways that they handle characters and certain scenes and certain overall arcs. So I definitely don't think that the show will ever be what it was in, say, season 4.
Yeah.
Which is arguably one of my favorite seasons.
Right.
But at the same time, I disagree with people that say that it's completely lost all of its magic, because there are still really, really impressive moments of acting and writing. And like I said, the entire visual of it is just on a completely different level than any other TV program. And if you go into it understanding that, I think that you'll enjoy it a lot more and kind of like sit back and let it take you over with the impressive cinematography and whatever. Right. And
it's kind of, it reminds me a lot of like David Lynch's Dune. Like, if you're familiar with the source material and you want to let it work, it will. But if you want to objectively look and say, there's big gaping holes here and this doesn't really make sense, and boy, they sure didn't introduce this character, then all that stuff applies. But I guess where I disagree with most of the fandom is, like, I put a lot more of the blame for the situation on Martin than I do in the Double D's. Because it's not like the Double D's signed up to write bad George Martin fan fiction. And the writing process almost guarantees that they do that, because where George can take an indefinite amount of time between Dance of Dragons and Winds with Winter, the Double D's, they get 4 or 5 months in between the thing premiering and starting up the next season, and that's it. They have to go with whatever they have, the best answer they've got, and roll with it.
Right.
And still hit, like, and it's not like they have unfettered, like, I can tell whatever story they want, because I'm pretty sure the option of just throwing all of, you know, George Martin's bullet points away and just doing whatever the hell we want, that was never an option on the table. So they're in this weird middle ground of having to write structured fanfic from this guy who's a gardener of a storyteller, and now they have to get like a little bit more, you know, architectural with it. And there's a lot of stuff that's not working. But the stuff that always worked, like you said, cinematography, I thought some of the dialogue, especially in Beyond the Wall, the different dialogue between the different, you know, facets of the Magnificent Seven, I thought the confrontations between Tyrion and Cersei and Jaime and Cersei and all those things were really excellent and as good as anything the show's ever done.
Yeah.
It's just, there is not, in every other season up until like the last two, maybe three, there's been a through line that you can intelligently follow and be like, well, yeah, of course, you know, if the house needed this and that and this other house needed, well, then of course it's inevitable that this would happen. And that's kind of been missing. Stuff has just kind of been happening by fiat. That's a little bit of a bummer.
Yeah, it's 100% a bummer, and I don't discredit anyone who still feels very strongly about what's happening. It's just that I personally think that I've come to terms with it, and therefore I choose not to dwell too harshly on those things, because I just set my expectations a little bit lower, and that's okay. And it's still like, that's still a very high bar for television, I think, at this point.
And and there's...
There
is nothing like Game of Thrones on television.
Right.
And until the next big budget fantasy extravaganza or you know, piece of historical fiction, there probably won't be.
I certainly do not envy the position that they are in with trying to bring this thing to a close. Mm-hmm. And I think I was maybe more nervous right up until The Dragon and the Wolf, the season 7 finale.
Me
and
too.
I thought that they completely stuck that landing in every way that they could have. And it made me feel better. Cause I honestly think the same thing happened last season with season 6. You can argue that Battle of the Bastards was like one of their best episodes visually, and a lot of that is due to director Miguel Sapochnik.
Yep.
But if you really try and poke holes in the writing, it starts to fall apart. Mm-hmm. And then they came in with The Winds of Winter, which was one of the best written episodes of the mm-hmm. season. And so I just try and focus on that and keep up, like, stay as optimistic as possible for this final season.
Do you think George Martin will write The Winds of Winter?
Yes.
Do you think
he has been writing it.
Do you think he will release it before season 8?
I don't know. I don't want to say yes, but I feel like I've always been too optimistic when it comes to, like, if you had, I'm pretty sure that I published an article in January of this year mm-hmm. on like how upset a lot of fans were, and right. people were starting to give up. And I interviewed Elio and Linda Antonsen.
Right. His collaborators on the world of Ice and Fire.
Yeah. To try and kind of like talk to them about what they think was happening. And even when I was working on that, I was like, oh, I'm going to, like, before I can get this article finished, she's going to announce it. Like she's going to scoop my story and uh-huh. like, and say that he's done.
Yeah.
And now it's been 8 months and joke's on me, because I was obviously being a sweet summer child in this past winter. So I don't know. I think that he could. And that's the thing, is it for the last, I feel like, 4 years, I've been saying he definitely could finish it this year. It's just whether or not that works out for him and his writing pace right now. I don't know.
It's just so weird to think that he was releasing preview chapters 3 years ago.
I know.
Like, I'm done. I'm just putting the finishing touches. Here you go. And I wonder if something happened to where he just had to throw all that stuff away. Because I honestly can't figure out, with as much as he's claimed to have cleared his schedule and just focused on finishing this up, and where I knew he was in like 2015, how in the world is this still happening, you know?
Right. Because he told his publishers that he could turn it in by August 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had to meet with them, right? And they extended the deadline to December.
Mm-hmm.
And then he blew that deadline. And that's when the big Not a Blog update came.
Yeah.
And he admitted that he had blown both of those deadlines, which means that at some point, right, in 2015, he was close enough that he thought that he was just months away.
And that's a great what if he had made that. If he had made that and it was good, which is another caveat, then where would we be, and would he be in position to? Because I feel like that if he finishes the Winds, or if he finishes the series, it's going to be after the show, and if the show is received well. Because I actually think that if the final season is kind of plays to mixed reviews, that it might. Almost fatally delay the series. Like so let me ask you this. Do you think, so you're bullish on The Winds of Winter. What about A Dream of Spring?
I don't know.
So you're even the summer child's not willing to stake out a claim on Dream of Spring, huh?
I think, well, so, you know, people, I think it was the incredible Joanna Robinson at Vanity Fair,
right.
Like, she floated the idea that he's been working on them simultaneously.
That makes a lot of sense. That does neatly explain the pussyfooting of 2015. That he's like, you know, I don't want to get myself into trouble with the feast and dance where it's like I thought I had the knot and untied, and then I released half the book, and now that's set in stone. And boy, I wish I could get some of those back.
I mean, he didn't call her out specifically, but he updated his Not a Blog, I think, after that article mm-hmm. and headlines like it started circulating, and he was like, it's ridiculous to think that I'm sitting on 2 completed books. And I was like, no one said that you're done with them, but mm-hmm. like, I think it's very possible that he got to a certain point, like you just said, similar to what happened with Feast and Dance, that he got to a certain point with Winds of Winter and said, oh crap, this is too long. I have to figure out where to end Winds now and begin Dream, which means that he's written material that will be in Dream, but he just hasn't figured out how it all sorts. And so I do really think that that's possible. And I do really hope that that is what's happening. I think worst case scenario is that his gardening style is what has stopped all progress, because we know that he was eventually forced to give David and Dan his bullet points for the ending. And there is a part of me that worries that as soon as he had to do that, he lost all creative drive to actually flesh out those bullet points into writing. Because when I talked to Linda and Elio, they said that for A World of Ice and Fire, they would be discussing a chapter or whatever, and 3 days later, George would send them like thousands of words on a history that they, you know, they only needed a few paragraphs on. And then all of a sudden there were tens and tens of pages of it. But they also said that those types of like history writings weren't things that he could ever then go back and write a fiction novel on, because he had already done it. It was like out of his system. He had said the main beats of what happened with those people all back then, and that was it. And so I do worry that as soon as he had to give up his general endgame to D&D, that he then lost the ability to fill in the blanks with what actually happens for us. And
that's scary. Do you have any hope? Because like my theory is that he's scared and nervous, and he's a natural kind of procrastinator, and those are toxic to that kind of creativity. And if Game of Thrones comes out and is widely hailed as like, you know, they, you know, Double D stuck the landing and oh, can't wait to see what George, like that might be the shot in the arm and the confidence that he has to just get like, and maybe it's just like, you know what, it's not so bad if I have to plow through some of this stuff, and it maybe it's not as elegant in my mind's eye as I imagined it, but if I get it out there, it'll be, I just don't know, I keep going, because, you know, even Game of Thrones, when it was great, was still a very streamlined and simplified telling of a very complex and interesting world. So, like, I do long to see the quote-unquote real way that this in-game unfolds, because you always get the Cliff Notes version on a television show, but, you know...
Yeah, like John and Daenerys becoming an item. I feel like I was very against that for a while, and I didn't let myself believe that George would actually pair them up romantically. And then this season I've kind of realized, and just after like talking to various people, like I interviewed Alan Taylor, who directed that episode. Mm-hmm. And he told me that like back in season one, George effectively told him that like everything was going to come down to these two characters. And at this point, I now believe that George will probably have them do some form of boat sex, but like, I will like it a lot more if I'm reading it from their points of view, and I'm getting chapters worth of them interacting with each other, and I'm in their heads, and I'm understanding what this attraction is all about. Whereas for me on the show, I think that fell flat just because it happened relatively quickly and awkwardly with the whole... I don't know. We can talk about that if you really want to.
No, but... I do, because like, I feel like it's so funny that you say that, because number one, just because they're together, there's still a whole lot of tragedy that could befall them in a very George-like manner.
Right.
You know, like it's the Song of Ice and Fire, but that doesn't mean they're going to be happy ever after. They're not going to be...
Oh, no way.
Yeah, no. They're not going to be Aragorn and Arwen on the throne of Gondor, but...
I'm with you. I heard Jim say that he thinks it's probable that they both survive, and I don't think that they're going. I think one of them has to die.
Yeah,
and I hope it's Daenerys.
but you know, I guess I never had the predisposition to just hate that, and also like I always try to keep in mind in the books how relatively young these people are, and even though they've been thrust in these very serious situations, you get. Like, for the very first time, these people are confronted with true peers. Like, you know, John never fit in with the Men of the Night's Watch because he was their betters. But yet the, you know, the other knights of the Night's Watch kind of like froze him out because he was a bastard. And he's all in like the free, you know, when he had this experience with Ygritte and the free folk, and it's kind of the same thing where he wasn't fully accepted. And then he had to constantly fight between the wildlings and the old guard of the Night's Watch. And this is the first time he's met a true peer. And the same thing for Dany. Like, it's, you got to go back to Drogo, and also has Dany recontextualized her relationship with Drogo, because when she was going on and on about all this,
basically the Stockholm syndrome.
Exactly. Has she kind of woken up to that fact? And this is like the first time that she's actually, you know, met this young, dashing, attractive, complicated, altruistic man that kind of like, you know, speaks her language and also is her peer. You know, he's not a Dario, like a groupie. You know, he's...
I think that all of those thoughts from both of them will be fleshed out in their chapters where they are like meeting each other and stuff. But instead, I feel like we got a lot of stilted dialogue of like them not really talking about anything other than like John constantly trying to be like, so Night King, and her being like, so bend the knee. And then like 4 episodes later. And also, like, we didn't even see their first kiss. I think that's what's driving me nuts, is that we literally cut from like them standing in front of each other fully clothed, and John is like consistently the most clothed person on the show, with like layers and layers and his furs and everything, to just like the most insanely awkward looking makeout position.
It was
the eye contact,
the way that they tried to have two naked people
be without not them being nude naked.
Was pretty entertaining.
And also, so that's another, speaking of like leaks and stuff, I think that is one thing that the leaks do to me, is that I got these bullet points of what would happen, and then I had months to like kind of imagine how they were going to do it. And everything about that Rhaegar Lyanna wedding interspersed with the boat sex was like as far away from my imagination as possible. Like, I thought we were gonna get like blue roses, and like I was not expecting Rhaegar to look a lot like Viserys, even though I realized that in the books they are said to look very similar, but I had kind of forgotten that. I was expecting this like handsome long-haired prince, and instead I like screamed when I saw like what I thought was Viserys marrying Lyanna. And then it was like interspersed with like again, I think I was expecting John and Daenerys' sex scene to be more romantic, and I do get why they made it awkward, because it's supposed to be awkward because it's incest, but
you've got Bran narrating it just to make sure we all know.
Just so weird, and I was so uncomfortable for that entire scene. And I think part of that is my fault for like knowing that it was coming and then putting all of my own, like, I was like directing it in my head for months, and then it just did not play out the way that I thought it would. But
like I said, I didn't have the plot, so I was kind of delighted that it was happening, because I thought that I guess it's admirable the restraint that they showed, you know, that like, you know, they got together and made moony eyes, and like, oh, this isn't right, and we have to pull back several times. So I was kind of, I guess I was ready for it. And you know, yeah, it's weird how HBO seems to be having this campaign to normalize incest with all their high concept dramas, but
we have like a minute and 45 seconds of non like Game of Thrones with no active incest,
right? Yeah,
between Jaime breaking up with Cersei and then Jon and Daenerys.
That's right. There was the one pure. That was the purest point of Game of Thrones, and then it got thrown out the window. So we get 30 minutes into conversation. The real reason I wanted to bring you on here, which is, what do you think, if any, season 7 has had an impact on any of the larger speculation about how this series is going to go down, and like popular theories? Like, I remember last time we talked about the fact that like Euron might become some sort of evil god. That's Emmett Booth's big theory. There's also like the fact that, like, you know, what does this mean about the dragon must have three heads prophecy that a lot of people thought would be Dany, John, and some combination of Tyrion or Bran warging, or perhaps somebody else riding the third dragon. That doesn't seem like it's going to happen. What What has this season done to the state of speculation in your mind?
It's interesting because this season, I feel like, has confused me even more about exactly what D&D are paying attention to when it comes to prophecy and what they're not.
Right.
Because, for example, the Daenerys infertility thing, it's still very confusing to me that they spent so much time this season with exposition about Miri Mazdoor telling her that she couldn't have a baby.
Right.
When they cut that line from season one.
Right.
Like, they specifically have her not say that line.
Yes.
And then they've decided now, six seasons later, oh shit, it was actually pretty important. We're gonna just, like, retcon that and, like, gaslight the audience into thinking that we did, like, no, we told you. We told you she can't have kids. And I'm like, no, you didn't. Like, you actually very specifically did it. And same thing with the Valonqar prophecy. So
right.
Now I'm very confused now as to whether or not that, like, have we all just been kidding ourselves since season five that they meant for book readers to understand that the Valonqar prophecy was in the show when they actually very explicitly cut that line of dialogue.
Yeah, I wonder if it's more like they were, because that, you know, in season one where they had the Miri Mazdoor stuff, that was before even Dance.
Right.
Which was the first book that kind of made Dany's infertility.
Right.
Like brought that back,
final chapter.
Brought that back around to, like, oh yes, this is something. So, like, you know, they wasn't sure how well that would be developed. And same thing, the Valonqar prophecy, like, you know, do they want to have their hands cuffed that they have to go this particular prophetic way? I mean, I've always been in a position that, like, even though the Valonqar prophecy is not in the show, it would blow my hair completely back to find out that whoever kills Cersei is different from whoever kills her in the book. Right. So, like, I've always used the way that, like, well, even though the prophecy's not in the show, we can use evidence of the prophecy to determine who might fit in the show, because what are the odds that it's going to be Jaime in the books and Tyrion in the show? Like, that would cause a lot of consternation. Same thing with the – I just figured that Dany would eventually not be infertile, and this is a classic double D's, like, eliminating extraneous plot points. But then – It is so weird to have them kind of bring this thing come roaring back. And I don't know, like, in one way I'm pleased because it serves my long running theory that there's going to be some form of democracy, you know, that, like, the getting Dany to think about, well, how do you, you know, you're the blood of the dragon and that's super important, but what happens if there's no more drops of dragon blood in the realm? And I'm kind of excited by that, but also I share your confusion about what the double D's think they've shown versus what they did show versus what they wish they showed.
Yeah. So, I mean, to that point, I think one of the biggest things that I'm now thinking of for the final season is definitely the whole Azor Ahai prince that was promised. And that's a big reason why I think either John or Dany won't survive, because if they are both meant to be this herald of Azor Ahai, I feel like it means one of them is going to have to not necessarily, like, murder the other, but I feel like one of them is going to die to represent that Nisa sacrifice.
Yeah.
That is then the impetus for the final whatever kiss of death on the Night King.
Right.
And the Long Night. And I also think that has to come back into play because and you and Jim talked about this on your recap, but Sam brought all these books and scrolls from the Citadel with him to Winterfell. And we now know that the way that Bran's powers work, when I talked to Isaac Hempstead right after the finale, he told me that it's basically like he has a Kindle library, but he needs to be told what book to go look for.
Right.
And then, which is like what we saw with the finale with Rhaegar and Lyanna's wedding. So I feel like Sam is going to get Bran to do some sort of exposition flashback to either the Long Night and Azor Ahai, or just some more information about the Night King, because in the first batch of season 7 photos that HBO released, there was a picture of Gilly reading a book about Azor Ahai.
Yeah, right.
And then in the premiere, they intentionally showed her picking up a book that was called The Long Night, and she kind of cracks it open and starts reading, but Sam is too busy reading about, like, the dragon glass, and so they never really go into that at all. But I think that I think D&D put that on the table so that they can bring it back in season 8 and go hopefully a little more into exactly what it means if either Jon or Daenerys is Azor Ahai and what it meant the last time that he was here and the Long Night and how that was all kind of wrapped up.
It does also seem that like Jon, that's the reason I think Jon's going to live and Dany's going to die, because it did seem with the 13 companions deal that they were doing, or the 12 companions deal rather, that they were intentionally trying to tell the book readers that Jon is the last hero.
Yeah, totally.
And you know, his is like, if you think, you know, the Rhaegar's prophecy, the Song of Fire, and his is the Song of Ice and Fire, that is pretty strong. And so that means that, you know, both of them can't survive because, number one, this isn't a storybook ending. And number two, I don't have a number two. That's just it.
It would also explain Melisandre purposefully didn't tell Daenerys that she thinks she is the prince or princess that was promised. She just said, you have a role to play,
right,
as does another.
Right.
And that would also fit very neatly with Jon being the Azor Ahai figure, but Daenerys being part of the legend, just not the part she thinks she is.
Right. And they could subvert it all in the end, and it turns out that Dany, you know, Jon's Anissa to Dany's the last, the prince that was promised. So, I mean, none of that is set in stone, but like, it just seems like that's where they're trying to indicate where things are going. Do you have any thoughts about, so let's talk more about the three-headed dragon prophecy. Do you have any more thoughts about, because that's something I've been trying to ponder this whole season, is the triplet prophecy that Dany gets about the three fires she has to light, the three mounts she has to ride, the three treasons that she will know. The thing about the three, and here's the thing that worries me, is they also seem to be setting up like this power struggle between Jon and Dany at the end. Like, that they're going to, you know, go through the Long Night and beat back the darkness and win. And then we're going to find out that Jon's actually Aegon Targaryen, or he's going to find out. And he's got the rightful claim to the throne. And Dany's just going to go fucking berserk about it or something. I'm super not looking forward to that because I don't buy it. But I could also see, like, that is the one thing that kind of fits all three of these things to... The fits all, like, because you could see that, like, I think she's already seen the treason for blood and the treason for gold. The treason for love, like, what else? Like, maybe Tyrion betrays her, or Jon seemingly betrays her or betrays her image of herself? Like,
yeah. I think it makes the most sense for it to be Jon. And, right, like, would him killing her be, like, that would fit?
Sure, sure.
If he has to kill her to fulfill this prophecy, and then that also happens to fulfill her treason for love prophecy. I can also see it as like her just taking it as treason.
That's what I meant. It wasn't lit like, right, like Jon doesn't have treason in his heart. She just, you know, right, this whole emphasis, exactly, on you must bend the knee, you must bend the knee, you must bend the knee. Like, they were trying to really sell, like, oh, and, you know, also the conversation between Varys and Tyrion that, like, you know, oh, look at here, Dany, she might be heading into Mad Queen territory. I'm just not buying it after her final, like, you know, the final things that we see in the season. Like, it just seems like.
Yeah. I definitely don't think it's going to be smooth sailing for the reveal and then them trying to figure out what they do with the information that Jon is actually the rightful heir. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I would caution people against thinking that they're going to go too far with it, because they did the exact same thing to us last season with Sansa and Jon. And they left us in the finale with this like uncomfortable look between Sansa and Littlefinger. And it was like, oh no, like, is Sansa going to be a problem for Jon as king in the North? And there were definitely threads of that, obviously. Mm-hmm. They butted heads a few times, and she still seems unhappy with his decision to go south. But there wasn't some big grand plot point about her trying to actually usurp him. And so I think it'll play out the same way with this and the Jon and Dany, Tyrion, everyone being worried about the fact that he's actually the rightful heir. Sure, it's going to be a bumpy road, but I don't think it's going to lead to any like drastic changes.
Well, that's the
thing. Any of their relationships.
Yeah, because like if Jon pushed to like look here, I'm the king,
But right, but that's not John.
Yeah, like John would be like, you know, I don't, I'm 1B to your 1A. I am the Jay-Z to your Beyonce. I don't give a shit. In a world, in a world that where Lemonade and 444 don't exist, I'm the Jay-Z to your Beyonce. That's fine. You can be the queen, and I'll be the king consort. I don't see John being like, no, damn it, this means I'm the boss. So you know, you got to bend the knee. Ha ha. I just don't see it happening.
I can see people around him saying that. Like, I can see even something like Ferris or the Northern Lords being all right, well, if you are actually the rightful king, like, damn it, we're going to make you the rightful king.
We're going to run shit.
It's not going to come from him. I can see her being uncomfortable with other people, like, trying to respect his claim. But again, I think that they're trying to lean into their affections for each other, mm-hmm. which I think will be the buffer here. Because, like you said, if they can just team up, then that will nullify any tension. And then I think what will happen is she will die and he will become the king anyways on his own.
Right.
Or whatever they're going to call it by the end of the series. Because I also agree with you that I don't think the Iron Throne and all the Seven Kingdoms are going to be a thing that one person rules over. But I think that he'll wind up being the last man standing, but it's not going to be because he stomped his feet and said, no, I'm Aegon Targaryen, the rightful heir to the Seven Kingdoms. So,
what do you think of the Aegon Targaryen thing?
Ugh, I didn't like that either. That was another thing in the leaks where I was like, really? Like, Aegon, I guess, you know, people have pointed out that there are some little, like, hints here and there in the books that Aegon makes sense, but I don't know.
Yeah, I saw analysis said that, like, Rhaegar is intentionally trying to create the triumphant, you know, the Aegon, Visenya, Rhaenyra's kind of triumvirate thing.
And a girl to be...
And then, you know, he dies, both of his kids die, and then Lyanna, you know, decides to respect his wishes to give him another Aegon. But it's so clunky. It's so clunky.
It is, and it surprises me.
And Aemon is right there.
Aemon is right there. I understood the Jaehaerys theory as well.
I like the Jaehaerys would have been better too, although I think it would have been more of a like the fuck from a show watcher's perspective.
Right. I mean, the way that I kind of soothe myself with the clunkiness of it is I just tell myself that it doesn't matter because I don't ever see him going by Aegon.
Yeah.
Like
I also really don't.
Not like by the end of the show, he's going to be telling people that his name is really Aegon and like, please don't call me John anymore.
No, where are you at with the fandoms liking to call him Aegon? And when referring, that's stop
so
it.
Confusing.
Stop it. And you're just trying to recapture the bullshit, like, oh, I know something you don't know, spoiler kind of thing. Because, like, there's
His
no
name
point.
Is Jon Snow.
There's no point referring him as Aegon Targaryen unless you're intentionally trying to confuse things or spoil people.
Yeah. No, it's really silly. And it doesn't, to me, it just doesn't matter because his entire identity and sense of self is wrapped up in his bastard name.
Yeah.
And I think that was part of the point of his whole conversation with Theon.
Exactly.
And, Theon underwent his own dealings with, reclaiming his name back from Reek. And the name that you're raised with is your name. It doesn't matter if you suddenly find out when you're, I don't know how old he's supposed to be in the show at this point, 22.
Right.
Like,
in his
it doesn't matter.
Sure. Right.
Yeah. His name is Jon Snow. And, I think King Jon Snow, first of his name, sounds way cooler than King Aegon Targaryen, sixth of his name, or whatever.
Yeah.
You know? Been there, done that.
Would he be sixth or five?
I don't remember.
Because I thought he was actually going to be seven, because I thought Rhaegar's Aegon was the sixth.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Because wasn't the good King Aegon, Egg the Unlikely, wasn't he the fifth?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. He'd be seven. Either way.
I don't know. What do you think about... I want to bring this back to Euron, because that was the theory that kind of caught my imagination preseason, the fact that, maybe Euron is going to become some dark god, or he might be the, little cuties of Borg spokesman, because that's one of the weaknesses of the Night King, is that his motivations...
He can't speak.
Yeah, he seems like he's just irredeemably evil, and his purpose is to destroy all life, and that's a very un-Martin thing. So, Euron would be the face of the Night King to kind of explain their motivations and give us a familiar face to espouse them. It doesn't feel like they're going for that.
Yeah. No,
but also, also, I don't think that Cersei, I got a piece of fan fiction I want to share with you that might bring it back around.
Great.
But yeah, I know that's my reaction to everyone I get in my email too. But, you know, I do think that Cersei's out of her mind if she thinks that he's going to take that gold, go over to Essos and bring back the Golden Company and be her everything.
Yeah, no, I think it's too late in the game for them to be like, if, and it's a big if, he returns in season 8 with the Golden Company, I feel like Dario has to be at its head.
Oh,
right.
But then he would disobey his queen's orders to stay and hold Meereen.
Yeah, because he's a sellsword. And yeah, I think he was butthurt that she left. And I don't think that it makes sense for them to bring in an entire new mercenary group with a bunch of unfamiliar faces and someone at the head of them. So I think if the Golden Company actually comes into play, I wouldn't be surprised if Dario is with them. And then it becomes like a weird day. Or like, and if that happens, Euron and Dario could decide to fuck over Cersei and just be Team Daenerys again, because I think Euron kind of gave Dany this look when she arrived in the Dragon Pit, and he said when he first came to Cersei and he said that he wanted to marry the most beautiful person in the world, he very deliberately did not say that it was her.
Yeah,
he kind of was just like, I want to marry the most beautiful person. And then in the books we have this entire Euron's plot to marry Daenerys thing. So I wouldn't be surprised if he does wind up flipping sides and not actually helping Cersei in the way that she's expecting him to. But I think it is a big question as to what, like, how far they go with that given the limited time that they have left, and what is his end game. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm wondering if he, because, you know, in the books, the Forsaken chapters, there's all this talk about him making all these blood sacrifices to bring this kind of Ragnarok situation to head.
Yeah.
And I wonder, if there's something so crazy, like Euron could take the all 1,000 men of the Golden Company and just offer him to the Night King as, like, a giant blood sacrifice, like just one horrific betrayal of humanity to, because again, there's my fan fiction, I'm trying to bring it back to Euron being the face of the bad guy. I don't know, that's kind of where I think is going to go, that he's going to like try to work out some deal with the Night King to get some sort of allegiance with him,
as like a way to kind of save his own skin. I think it would make it a lot more interesting to have it not be such a one-sided humanity versus unhumanity battle. But at the same time, there's a part of me that doesn't have enough faith in, like, I feel like that's like the opposite of what they tend to do. I feel like D&D tend to take the simplest route to get from point A to point B because, like you said, they don't have George R. Martin's roadmap anymore.
But they do to some extent. And that's the thing. There's like, I was the biggest hater of the whole fucking Cthulhu bullshit on the Greyjoy stuff.
But if we get a fucking Kraken battle for humanity.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I just feel like there's just too, like, I agree with this, I just feel like this poor Quentin guy, Booth Jacob, or Jonathan, what the hell? Why can't I never remember this guy's name?
just call him Emmett Booth.
Emmett Booth, thank you. There's too much information that's pointing towards that for it to all be nothing. Now, I do like your idea of Dario riding at the head of Golden Company, because that also would qualify as treason and a treason for love. So you could do something like that and not have Jon and Dany turn against each other.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that this is one of the times where, like, I mean, you can say the same thing about Dorne. Obviously, Dorne has a much bigger role to play than they do in the show, because they've basically been written out of the show.
Right.
I highly doubt that we're going to ever get a reference to them again, unless it's like in the season series finale and they're like, oh, right, remember this whole other Seventh Kingdom. So like, I feel like Euron is one of those characters that has so much potential in the books and we don't know what's happening yet, but I'm not sure how much of that is actually going to make it into the show.
Also, Clegane Bowl is definitely happening, right? I mean, we saw the weigh-in for it. So
yeah, we saw the weigh-in. Qyburn is off manufacturing medieval air horns. that's been the delay this whole time.
Right.
That there's no air horn yet in Westeros.
Right.
To play, it's going to be like trumpets or something. It has to happen, if only for the fan service.
Right.
Sometimes I don't like fan service, but when D&D do it right, they do it damn right, and I feel like they're going to give us the Clegane Bowl payoff.
It is funny, because I always felt like there's like two sections of like the analysis community, one that's a little bit more scholarly, and one that's a little bit more like, wouldn't it be awesome if, and like
one that has air horn apps downloaded onto their phone.
Exactly. And I feel like that's been kind of a bitter conflict, because it's went from like, okay, settle down, the Hound's over in his quiet aisle and that's his piece and why it doesn't make any narrative sense, to like, okay, well, grudgingly it might happen, but here's the reasons this would violate all these character points, to like, God damn it, you guys are fucking right. And it's like, it's been interesting.
I love the people that try and say like, well, yeah, it's going to happen and the Hound is going to die and then you're all going to be sorry. And I was like, why would you say that?
I mean, yeah. And also like, yeah, no one says the Clegane Bowl has to have a happy ending. It just has to happen. Right. Yeah. So
that was another thing when I read the leaks that I was like, oh, really?
you're a hype slayer, eh? You wanted it to happen this season, yeah. Yes. Now, what do you think? Because I already got a couple of theories in my mailbag that saying, like, you know, add the Hound saying, you always known who's coming for you, with Arya always having the mountain in her prayers, with the mountain or the Hound saying conspicuously, I'll never get in Arya's way. AKA there's going to be subversion of the Clegane Bowl when, surprise, it's Arya that somehow either avenges the Hound because he's already dead and she's wearing his face, or I don't know. There's some crazy, crazy convolutions in this theory, but do you think there's any possibility that Arya is the one that does in the mountain rather than the Hound?
No. I mean, that's a really cool idea, and hats off to everyone that connected all those dots, but once again, D&D go for the simplest solution a lot of the times, and I don't think that they're trying to do backflips around Clegane Bowl. I think that they're just holding. I think that they're teasing us. They know how much they're teasing us with it, and they're just waiting until the final season to do it. It is interesting to try and figure out now how it's going to happen, because we're back to having them on opposite sides of Westeros again.
Someone suggested it's going to be a champion type of situation, which I would find very unsatisfying. Like, you know, kind of like, you know, what happened.
Like like a trial by combat.
Exactly. Again? Like, kind of like what happened outside the gates. Was it Marine where they sent their champion and then, you know, and it's like this one throw for the gates of the city like that, you know.
No.
Yeah.
I feel like it has to happen either in the Red Keep, in some sort of like last gasp of Cersei's powers, or like in a chaotic battlefield, and we get like that epic one-on-one, you know, the field goes quiet because the Cleganes are fighting each other,
right?
Type of scenario.
The deafening horns,
all the air horns that Qyburn had created in.
So I just want to let you turn the tables, because like I've essentially hounded you with question after question. Did you have anything that you wanted to bring? There's one more thing I want to talk about, but it might not even make the podcast. Is there anything that you have like rattling around in your head that you want to talk to me about?
I mean,
it's fine if you don't.
I just want to thank you for also throwing cold water on the Bran as the Night King theory repeatedly, because like, God damn, that is annoying me.
the thing about all these theories, what makes Game of Thrones really maddening to cover, is like anything's possible.
Right.
Anything's possible. So,
I just feel like the bar is too low right now.
Yes, it really is. It really is.
For fan theories. Like, it's It's yeah. too much.
Yeah, like you can't say like, wouldn't it be cool? You have to have like, where is the thematic? It's not just thematic. It has to mechanically be possible, which is a low bar, very low bar to hurdle. It has to make a narrative sense, and it has to also satisfy some sort of character arc, because everything's going to be about wrapping up. Think about all the characters we still care about.
Yeah.
There's like 24, and all of those have to have some sort of satisfying end, or some kind of through line to have a satisfying place where you can kind of leave them.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of room for like, you know, oh, it was Bran all along, and what does that mean for his character, and what does that mean for? I mean, yeah,
no,
you got to be able to.
It
answer
doesn't mean
those
anything
questions.
Because it's not true.
Right.
Because it's like, yeah, it doesn't. The one thing that I keep seeing people talk about this theory, and no one has convinced me of a good reason why. Okay, say Bran accidentally passed warged into this man who was turned into the Night King, and
right.
it was all a mistake, and it's such a tragedy. All right, so then please explain to me why he is now marching south and destroying all of humanity, because
yeah,
like why?
Yeah.
Why is Bran?
Bran's
Night
gone
King?
Inside being. I mean, the Bran's gone insane, spending 8,000 years inside a zombie corpse. You know, I mean, there's always an answer for it, but again, how does this satisfy any of the main narrative plots? How does this give us insight into Bran's character? How would that give us insight into the Night King characters? Like all kinds of questions that can be asked there.
Yeah, it's too much.
Anything, Kim Renfro, thank you for coming on to the show once again. I assume that you have other things going on besides Game of Thrones. You're not just going to sit dormant for the next 12 to 18 months. What do you got going on over the Insider?
So we are still doing our podcast, which is Showrunners, and I think that we have like 5 new episodes coming up. I haven't hosted any of them, but my co-host Nick is going all in on that, and I'll hopefully be recording new episodes. But yeah, check out our podcast. It's called Showrunners. We interview a different showrunner of a show every week. The name gets kind of repetitive, but you get the idea. It's really fun. We kind of go all in on like behind the scenes and the writing process and how these different series all come to life. And that should be pretty awesome. And then Westworld comes back spring. I know you guys have your awesome coverage of it. I will also be doing my web thing with Westworld when that returns. And so that's kind of the next big thing on the horizon. So,
right on. All right. Well, that'd be cool. Like maybe we can do some cross pollination when Westworld comes running around too.
Yeah.
So,
I would love that.
It's
such a rich show.
Yeah.
There's so much going on.
Yeah. But you should definitely check out the show, because right now, like you guys had a hiatus between seasons, but you talked to Damon Lindelof about The Leftovers, Fuller and Green about American Gods, Bruce Miller for The Handmaid's Tale, and more. So it's a really, like, I'm the biggest The Leftovers fan on the planet, or, you know, I'll fight someone for the title, and I really enjoyed your interview with him. So
yeah, that was awesome.
Well, stay in touch, Kim. Thanks for coming on the show.
Where
do we find you at the insider.com?
Yeah, this is insider.com is our website, and you can find me on Twitter at Kim R. Renfro and follow the links there and you'll find me.
There you go. All right. Well, we'll hope to have you on real soon. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah. Thank you. Bye.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move. House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right. Thanks once again for Kim for joining us on that. Again, as soon as we're done with the outro here, we will play the remainder of our conversation that deals with the outstanding spoiler leak from Season 7 that will be, I think, rolling into Season 8. Could be wrong because who the hell knows. But I want to give everybody an opportunity to bounce out of here. The full spoiler podcast will be out this Friday morning. That will not be the final Game of Thrones podcast, of course. We start with Season 2 next week. We will be doing a combined so we haven't talked about this, but we'll try to do Season 2, the recap and initial feedback point, spoiler-free. So, like, if you're listening to this from the very beginning, you will not be spoiled by anything if you listen to the main recap part. But then we'll be playing our music and we'll make the spoiler a part of that podcast, where once you get past the music, we start talking about Game of Thrones as a whole outside of just Season 2 and even current stuff. So if you'd like to send feedback on that game and start to watch with us, start watching Season 2, Episode 1, send feedback into Game of Thrones at baldmove.com. We'll start there next week. If you want to hear the last remaining discussion of leaks for the Season 7, stay with me and Kim. If not, stop the podcast right now. Stop it. Stop it. I don't want to hear anything about weak willpower, being able to resist. I'm telling you right now, if you don't want to hear any possible leaks for Season 8, just bail. Bail now.
There's nothing else after this.
Nothing. There's nothing but pain for you past this next interlude. So you've been warned. We'll see you with the full spoiler wrap-up at the end of this week and Season 2 next week. Until then, I'm Aaron. See ya. The one thing that stuck out to me in an otherwise unblemished, perfect prediction track record was a lone bullet point towards the very end that says Cersei wakes up in a bed full of blood. The implication yes. is that she has miscarried.
Yes.
What the fuck? Is that real? Was that their shitty attempt at a canary in the coal mine? Was that something that they decided? Because, you know, we know a lot of things get written that don't get shot. A lot of things get shot that don't make it to the final cut. You know, there's a lot of consternation about. In fact, did you break this? Did you break the what? Thing that Isaac Hempstead Wright revealed? Okay, because I
remind me.
Sorry, because no, there is like it's so funny because like 3 weeks in a row, people sent me columns from you to like weigh in on something we were talking about, and I'm like, aww, yeah. So that's cool, but like you're big on fucking Longclaw opening his eyes in that debate.
Oh God, yeah,
yeah,
that was a pain in my butt.
Yeah, but. Yeah. But anyway, this let's talk. What do you think? Where were they going with this miscarriage? Is the miscarriage real? How does this change things? Is it going to the thing that scares me is I kind of feel like it might be something that is in play next year.
Yeah, I think it's going to happen in season 8, and they just decided to kick the bucket down the road a little bit, if I had to bet, because everything else in that bullet points, like all of those,
everything, yeah.
The fact that everything else was so accurate makes me think that they might have even filmed it, but decided that was just like one too many things to have in this, you know, 80-minute
It's a packed final 15 minutes too, really.
Right. And I also think that they probably cut it because it serves up some sympathy for Cersei in an episode where I don't think that we need to have any sympathy for her. Jamie riding away was so great and something that fans wanted to see forever.
It was
that
good.
Then immediately handing them a reason to like feel kind of bad for Cersei again was probably too much whiplash on her character, I think.
So what do you think? Because my first thought was this puts Cersei back in a situation where, because I was just thinking like before I read that, like, oh my God, Cersei's going to go full fan for the opera next year. She's going to be trapped in this gloomy tower with her swollen belly and Qyburn whispering poison in her ear and the mountain looming behind her. And she is going to be this giant bloated spider thing that they have mm-hmm. to come back to, this purely malevolent force. And I feel like this just heightens it. But on the other hand, one of the reasons she was emboldened to let Jaime go is because she feels like she's got a shot at a family again. And if that goes away, does that make her, is this going to open up, like, from the books, the raven message she sends to Jaime, like, oh, my love, please come back and save me and blah, blah, blah. And he crumples it up and throws it into the fire. Or what is this just going to make her that much more evil and wretched when we finally come back to have to deal with her? Or what do you think's happening here?
I do think that they need to push her to be a little bit more unhinged than she's been so far. I mean, she's obviously done horrific shit and is very, very bad, but book Cersei is even more like in her own mind and paranoid and hysterical, I think, and we haven't quite seen that yet, and I wouldn't be surprised if like this final loss of a child like is the thing that kind of does her in mentally. And
I'm wondering how much more done in she can be, because she's essentially plotting against all humanity at this point. And
she is, but like people pointed out that her plans are mostly pretty logical.
Yeah,
like,
she's made a hard turn towards Tywin Town this year, which surprised me. And I also suspect that maybe that will happen in the books.
Maybe, but in the books she thinks she's on the train to Tywin Town, and everyone around her
is like,
you are doing the stupidest stuff possible. And
right.
I think in the books, she's supposed to kind of reap the punishment from that a little bit more with her choice of arming the Faith Militant. And in the show, she kind of cleaned up that mess right away and hasn't had any ramifications for it. And so I feel like she's sitting a little bit too comfortably now. And it would make sense to me if they kind of make her snap and start doing things that are actually more detrimental to her safety.
Yeah, that makes sense. Right. Although it wouldn't surprise me if Martin does something kind of like what they did to Double D's to Jamie, where Jamie, you know, they show him to be a little bit of outmatched against Rob, and he gets captured at Whispering Woods, and then he says to Elena, "Well, yeah, I've made a lot of mistakes, and I've learned from them. I wonder if, because you know, we still got two books to go in the books, and like Cersei did a lot of stupid things that got her into a lot of trouble, and Jamie's not going to bail her out of it. So I wonder if I doubt that she dies." At the hands of the Faith Militant and at the hands of the High Sparrow. So I assume she wriggles out some way. And I wonder if that's the story they're going to tell is, you know, it's kind of Cersei triumphant and transcendent. And but she's, you know, like maybe she could be the ruler that she always wanted to be, but she's facing a threat that she could never have conceived of before. And I don't know.
Yeah. Either way, that baby's not living because that goes against both the show and book prophecy.
You think so? Why?
Well, I mean, in the show, they already kind of like screwed by, like, they had her have her little black haired baby, but it still died.
Right.
And so I do think that they should still be sticking to the fact that she will only have three children that live and like for a period of time, not just
so you don't like the theory that Dany will still be infertile and there's some kind of tragic scenario where Cersei delivers her child. She dies because, of course, she's Cersei and the thing has to and Jon and or Dany have to raise this orphan kid as their own. And that's going to bring kind of their plot back around. That's going to be the bittersweet ending, you know?
No.
Yes, that is my rebuttal.
No, I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. Because the reason why I don't think that there's going to be any Lannisters left, except maybe Tyrion and Jaime by the book's end, and I think it's also very likely that Jaime dies because. Yeah. He always says that him and Cersei are going to leave the world together.
Well, right. And Cersei says as much, too. So they do seem very much like they're joined in life and death.
So if we're talking about, like, the importance of narrative and impact on the general arc, I think that it makes a lot of sense that Tywin's entire obsession with legacy and trying to force Jaime and Cersei to be the two children of his that actually carry on the family name. It makes sense to me that those two would eventually die mostly because of mistakes that they've made and that Tyrion is ironically the only one left to actually carry on that name. And then like, who knows, Tyrion could probably have a kid at some point.
Hell, but, Tyrion probably already has a dozen kids.
That's true. So it doesn't make sense to me to actually hand Cersei/Tywin that tiny victory of actually producing an heir to the Lannister name that is then raised as like the golden child of Westeros. That just seems detrimental to the deeper irony of Tywin actually ruining his family legacy instead of preserving it.
All right, well, I'm trying to think of a rebuttal to that because I guess, like, you know, would it be interesting if it turns out, because, you know, another thing I get been getting a lot of feedback is like, is this Euron's baby? And that would be, but I don't know, because then it's like, is that, how much of that stuff really matters? And where is it? Like I said, there's a part of me that sees there's a dramatic irony between Jon, you know, legitimizing this bastard child for the good of the realm, where his father bastardize a legitimate heir for the good for the personal good of, you know what I'm saying, like that's it's an interesting inversion somewhere there that I'm not quite got my hands on, but you know, so anyway, Kim Renfro, thank you.